You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Roses. There is no escaping the storm of roses crisscrossed on the split cracked wall of a dead fountain arch. There is no escaping their uterine balls expanding as a reminder of the children I never had. If you listen carefully, you can hear the vibrations, the heart drone of their petal jaw harps. And there's no going back, no in discovery of Mars or these red planets brooding before me. Light predators, sun-hatched and bloodening like the fists of women who have gone to war.
The Scottish Poetry Library's Poetry Podcast series prides itself on bringing you the best new Scottish poets as well as established names. In this episode, we bring you one of the most exciting poets to emerge in recent years on the Scottish stage. Her name is Marion McCreadie, and she's already had one great debut collection come out last year, in point of fact, on Eyewear Publishing, and it was called Tree Language. Her work is also about to appear as one third of the debut volume in a new poetry series. It's called Triptych Number 1, Our Real Red Selves, and it's published by Vagabond Poets, and it will feature work by two other Scotland-based poets, Harry Giles and J.L. Williams. Full disclosure, I'm the editor of that book. Anyway, I caught up with Marion last autumn when we spoke about nature poetry, visiting Jerusalem, and why rhubarb is so sinister. I guess there's a lot of what would loosely come under the terms of nature poetry and tree language. I guess the fact you've got tree in the title,
yes,
kind of nods towards that, yeah. But it's not nature poetry as people might be used to. There's not a lot of what you might call comforting, Wordsworthian homilies.
Yeah. I'm quite happy to call it nature poetry or maybe landscape poetry. I kind of like, I'd rather people didn't have expectations and they were surprised rather than trying to say it's something like dark and meaningful kind of nature poetry and then have them expecting something and not getting what they're expecting. So I kind of like to surprise. I like to just jump into a poem and for them to have no, just kind of take it from there, take it from the poetry.
Is that for when you're writing them? Does something similar happen? Do you surprise yourself when writing?
Absolutely, yeah. Always, I never know where a poem's going to go when I start. I'll start with an image, or rarely a rhythm, but sometimes mainly an image, a couple of words. Normally I've got pages and pages of notes and images, and I just kind of scroll through them and see what grabs me. And I think what's got an energy behind it, that there's something that I don't understand why it's jumping out at me, but it is. So let's just explore that and see where it goes.
So you're more interested maybe in mood than perhaps trying to communicate a story or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I'm interested in exploring themes, big themes, that's all poets want to do, but through little details. I think it's a very effective way to explore the bigger themes. Just focus on the external, the natural world around us, and use that to explore, really trying to discover what's going on in the subconscious in a way. You know, landscape is something that's always around us, and even if you live in a city and you're not particularly thinking about flowers or trees or things like that, it's still there, and it affects us, it affects all of us, whether we're aware of it or not, and it's just thinking about that.
But for a first collection, it's a very strong voice. You know, I didn't feel that it was like a rambler or a botanist with a notebook out neutrally noting down details of this plant or this landscape. It felt very authored in a sense. It felt very much like it was emerging from a certain internal pressure, perhaps. You know, there was a real feeling that if you read this book, you got a sort of feeling you were being dipped in a certain kind of atmosphere or mood. You know, it wasn't just a sort of a neutral kind of thing. There was a real sense of character and place and atmosphere.
Certainly, in the terms of just going around and writing about things for the sake of it. That's not what I want to do. I want to explore deeper things that I don't really understand, and I write to kind of understand them, I suppose. I go with the mood, I go with the image, and, well, you know, poetry is a bit of a mystery, how it happens. I don't know how it happens. And
Well, I mean, that's interesting, because there is there's a real sense of the strangeness in nature in the book, and
yeah.
It's mystery and it's unknowability. I mean, you've even got, I mean, the book is full of great titles, by the way, but there's one called The Pond is an Unknown Force. You know, this sort of sense that, you know, you're noting these things down, but it's almost the closer that you move towards these things, the more you realise there's a sort of certain impregnable barrier stopping you from really understanding it.
That's part of what poetry wants to do, is explore these things that we don't really understand, but we all kind of have a sense of somewhere, and it's just trying to tune into that. Into the mysteries. I think there was a quote from Retke about being open to the mysteries in nature, and I think it's a part of that. And that it's not just nature for its own sake, but how it reflects back in human nature.
Mm.
And I guess that's what I'm interested in.
But in that quote that's the epigraph to one of the sections, I think it says, if you leave yourself open to nature, you're also make yourself vulnerable, I think, as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of danger, and I guess there's a lot of wound imagery in the book as well, woundedness as well, you know, that comes through as well. So it's not like I say, a neutral thing where you're noting it down. There's a sense sort of, if you open yourself up to this, there's a real sense that it'll double back on you. You know, you're not going to just get out of this exchange with a nice poem. There's going to be there's a sense that if you open yourself up to nature, you're opening yourself up to all kinds of forces, which, you know, you might leave a mark on you.
I'll just read the quote. I've got it here. Those who are willing to be vulnerable move among mysteries.
Mm.
And I think that's a really powerful thought. And I think it's about, certainly when I write about a part of nature, I really want to kind of open myself up to, what am I projecting into this?
Mm.
Along with what is actually physically there, and also what's it tapping into, what are the underlying mythologies and folklore that it's tapping into, because, you know, nature, it's been there, so it's, you know, everyone knows flowers have their own folklore and references, and it's just kind of exploring what are the underlying things about the different parts of nature that reflect that back to us.
Mm.
And yeah, it's also, I mean, it comes from like fairy tales and things as well. Like probably most people, I was immersed in Grimm's fairy tales growing up. And if you look into the fairy tales, there's lots of little verses interspersed between the stories about, you know, trees talking and kind of being a revealer of the truth.
Mm.
About, you know, if someone's murdered someone else, it's the tree that tells you, or the bird that tells you. And it's like, you know, nature's kind of there and expressing these things to us. And yeah, there's no escaping from it.
a lot of those childhood stories, I don't know if you really realise at the time, but there's a sort of real sinister edge to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was also, as you were talking, there thinking of Ring a Ring of Roses, A Pocket for the Posies,
right.
Which, you know, is a nice rhyme, and you find out it's about the plague.
Yeah, exactly, yes, and that's the kind of things it's...
Yeah.
It's using, and it's something I'm very interested in writing at the minute. I'm writing poems probably quite different from the ones in tree language, but, you know, kind of moving along the nursery rhyme. In fact, there's one poem in tree language where I kind of use the nursery rhyme route to actually, you know, it's something on the surface that seems quite nice and, you know, friendly, but actually there's something dark under there.
Is this the unintelligible conversation?
Yeah,
rhubarb.
Yeah.
You know, that I knew you were meant that one, because it's quite a short poem.
Mm.
Listeners, if you haven't read it, maybe Marion will be kind enough to read it for us later.
Yeah.
On. But it does have a very sort of sing-song sense to it, but it's like a Ring a Ring of Roses, because you get sort of absorbed by the rhythm of it, and when you actually look at it, there's a real sort of chilling aspect.
Yeah,
it seems to
yeah.
be about almost about dead children or
yes.
something.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, these are the darker aspects of life that, you know, sadly exist around us, and I think, you know, for myself, when I had my two children, you do live in the constant fear of caught death for 6 months.
Mm.
And this is, you know, it's incredibly intense. So I guess a lot of these ideas and poems kind of came out of those experiences.
Yeah, because a lot of the poems reference the death of children, actually,
yeah.
or children being hurt or injured.
Yeah.
And it helps to create this sort of very strong atmosphere, which is unforgettable, actually. But it's also, speaking as someone who doesn't actually have children himself, it haunts you. When I say haunt, I mean haunt in the best sense possible. And it's very memorable.
Thank you.
The unintelligible conversation of unpicked rhubarb. Silver rain flies through tumbleweed trees. Black-eyed brambles are knocking at the door. The babies lie three on the dining room floor, one named 40 and one named 4, and the other face down is no more.
I wanted to ask about daffodil horns as well. I mean, ask about daffodils, full stop, actually. If you write a poem in which daffodils appear, you know, you're going to think about Wordsworth,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, it's risky, isn't it? Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you were to ask the layman, as it were, on the street, you know, name a nature poem, a poem that makes you think about nature, that if they don't say, you know, something by Burns, like To a Mouse or that, if you ask somebody, maybe not in Scotland, they'll say daffodils. They'll say, you know, I wandered lonely as a cloud. Your take on daffodils, I think, is almost a 180-degree take from Wordsworth, whereas Wordsworth seems to, you know, take comfort from the
yeah.
daffodils.
Yeah.
There's a real chilling element
yeah.
to yours. The last lines are, we do not understand, and the daffodils, they spread like cancer. When I was talking to my girlfriend about your poetry and what I liked about it, I said to her, it's like nature poem that's unnatural. She pointed out that cancer actually is very natural. It occurs throughout the natural world. But you know, maybe you know what I mean. It's not there to make you go, isn't nature lovely or wonderful?
Yeah.
It's closer to the nature red in tooth and claw aspect of nature writing.
I think there's a history of that in poetry as well. I think there's that kind of alternative nature poetry. If you look for it, you'll find it.
Daffodil horns. Star splayed. Mouse from the yellow bellies of starfish. Flat and helpless. Mouths unshuttable, though mute, unstoppable. Culled from our garden, these lamp, shade and bulb trespassers, periscope from the bottom of a foreign vase. Though we listen, we do not hear. Though we see, we do not understand. And the daffodils, they spread like cancer.
I guess part of it again is not just about the daffodil, it's about what's that tapping into? What am I bringing to the daffodil? Sounds a bit silly, but but really, you know, focusing on these things intensely. I was reading recently about Rilke and his concept of focusing intently on an animal, for instance, and exploring what actually, it's not just writing an ace poem about an animal, but really what's that tapping into that's much deeper, what's really going on there. And I think also for me, I'm a Christian, and I think nature can be slightly complicated for a Christian, because in the one sense, it's, you know, it's a, I believe it's the work of creation, the work of God. But the Bible says that no one has an excuse not to believe because of nature. So it's kind of almost like it's a source of judgment as well. On the one hand, you know, we're in awe of the work of God. On the other hand, well, it's there to kind of, it's judging us. I don't know if that makes sense, but that kind of, you know, these are things that I think about.
I want to tease out a bit more about this idea of nature judging us, because usually in poetry, I guess, human beings, writers, inevitably put themselves at the centre of it, you know, like Wordsworth
yeah.
does, you know. Are you trying to do the opposite? Are you trying to sort of put the nature first and then see where the human fits into that?
Yeah, I mean, I play a couple of mind games. I can't remember where I got the idea from. I read it at some point, talking about trying to remove your centre of self into an external object and view things from that perspective. And the first time I tried to do that, it's quite an intense a kind of game to play. But the first time I did that, suddenly everything seemed quite sinister.
Mm.
And that's the first time I kind of wrote, if you well, a kind of sinister nature poem. And I would, you know, I began to think deeper about what does that really mean to me, because before that, you know, poetry was something lovely and all the rest of it, but it really made me think about what is nature doing there. It's the backdrop, it's almost kind of like it sees everything. Nature sees everything, it sees all the actions, it sees babies being hurt, it sees us carrying out our actions, almost like these silent witnesses.
Mm. But I mean, when you say it's almost like nature's omnipresent, or
yeah.
I mean, that's almost like God itself, isn't
yes.
it? So although, do you identify God with
nature?
Nature?
Not God in nature as such, but certainly it seems that nature has a kind of authority, almost, in a sense. Things like, I was always fascinated as a child by thinking about, I think it's a round tree, there's one story, fairy tale about a round tree, and it's like the round berries are the blood crying of someone who's been murdered. So it's kind of like nature is testifying to that. And there's a bit in the New Testament where Jesus says, when the Pharisees were told him to tell the crowds to stop shouting and glorifying him, and he said even if they were to be quiet, the stones themselves would burst out in praise. So it's kind of like thinking about the animate side of nature, but also inanimate objects like stones. And really, you know, they're all, what are they all doing there?
Yeah. Your poem, Brambles, has that sort of line about the blood, the tears, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. And that was the first poem, actually, I wrote. I was just quite surprised. I didn't really know where it came from at first, but it was something I thought, yeah, I need to explore this. And I've since come across plenty of other poets who have likewise explored the darker side, maybe not in the same way that I approach it, but doing a similar thing, just but with a different, I guess, view of what's going on.
Wild poppies. And how do you survive your long throat, your red rag to a bull head? You rise heavy in the night, stars drinking from your poppy neck. Your henna silks serenade me under the breadth of the Pyrenees. You move like an opera, open like sea anemones. You are Earth's first blood. How the birds love you. I envy your lipstick dress. You are urgent as airmail, animal red. Ash Wednesday crosses tattooed on your head. Your butterfly breath releases your scents, your secrets, bees blackening your mouth. As your dirty red laundry all hangs out.
I've recently been putting together a collection in Scotland's younger poets, and it's the case that apart from one other poet, I think no one else really writes any kind of religious poetry
yeah.
at all, or
yeah.
maybe spiritual and
yes.
with a small s. And funnily enough, when they write nature poems, it's much more positive, funnily
yeah.
enough. So it's interesting that someone who is really actively interested in religion and writes
yeah.
poems on that nature doesn't.
I just can't write the nice ones. I've tried, but it doesn't work for me. Love to be able to write nice nature poems, but it's not. I guess it's not what I'm really wanting to write
yeah.
at the end of the day. So.
But if you're actually, I mean, if you actually have read the Bible and you're
yeah.
interested
yeah.
in God, you
yes.
know that it's not all. You know, bashing tambourines and singing
no,
Kumbaya,
of course
is it?
It's not, of course it's a continual struggle.
Yeah, especially if you've read the Old Testament
yeah,
as well. You know,
of course.
It's a very dark
yeah.
text.
Yes.
And if you come to the Old Testament from just attending Sunday school and seeing sort of Christian cartoons and whatnot, you can really come up against it and really get a fright about, you know, the dark nature is sort of. The Old Testament, the sort of the dark poetry that's in it. It's fascinating to me, actually, and I take it something like that is what's captured your imagination too.
Quite possibly. Certainly, you know, if you look at the Psalms, you know, that's the main section of poetry in the Old Testament. Yes, there's lots of lovely ones, but there's a lot of quite dark ones as well. So quite possibly. I hadn't really thought of that, but yeah.
Mm. What is it about rhubarb? I mean, rhubarb to me is fairly innocuous. You've managed to make me think of rhubarb as a sinister thing now. That's quite a compliment to your poetry, that you can turn something that I associated with dessert into this sort of odd, leathery, you know, leafy thing that sits in your garden waiting on you.
Well, I've just recently written another rhubarb poem. you know, I do ask myself, what did the rhubarb do to deserve this?
I guess it's quite fleshy, isn't it, rhubarb?
Yeah, and I think it is slightly sinister.
It's got that sort of plasticky sort of sheen to it as well.
Well, I mean, we moved to our current flat at the minute a couple of years ago, and there was a massive big rhubarb patch in the back garden, and none of us like rhubarb. And I've now recently just met someone who actually likes rhubarb, so I'll be able to pick it and give it to them. But otherwise, it grows and grows, and it's just... Yeah, it does have a kind of sinister feel, like it's just taking over.
Mm. It rustles as well. And
yes.
It has a sort of, the leaves form a sort of canopy so you can't see what's
that's
going
right.
on underneath.
Underneath, yeah, that's correct.
Mm.
And I used to, as a child actually, in Lewis, I spent every summer in Lewis, that's where my mum's side, my family are from. We used to go to the beach, a big macher, having to tunnel our way through giant fields of rhubarb.
Yeah.
So quite possibly there's some latent fear there of the rhubarb. I don't know.
Could be a terrible B movie, Attack of the Killer Rhubarb. So you said you're from Lewis and you now
mm-hmm.
live, is it Dunoon?
Dunoon, yeah. I mean, I was born in Lewis, but my parents moved from there when I was pretty young, but I spent every summer up there.
I was going to ask if moving from an island lifestyle to
mm-hmm.
a mainland lifestyle had any effect on your imagination, but I guess if you were quite young, maybe
I was
not.
Very young, but in saying that, I mean, Dunoon isn't an island, but it does feel like an
mm-hmm.
island. You know, it's a peninsula, but it's a long way around to drive, and quite often in the winter there's landslides and we're cut off anyway, so we essentially are an island at that point. So it very much does have the feel of an island.
Sense of isolation.
Yeah,
that's
it's like
chilly.
Just being cut off there.
I suppose there's that. I mean, in terms of what other sort of poets your generation are doing, it does feel, if I can stretch this metaphor somewhat tenuously, that you're a little bit different. You are on your own peninsula there, you know, with the rhubarb and the the cancerous daffodils. Before signing off, I wanted to ask you about one of the later sections in the book, that's Promised Land section.
Sure.
So is this based on a trip to Jerusalem you took?
Yeah, it was, yeah, a couple of years ago.
When you arrived there, you thought, this is a landscape I need to write about.
Well, I knew it would be a place that I would have to write about, absolutely. It was a dream fulfilled to go there, and I knew it would be good, but I didn't know. Jerusalem is just a strange world all by itself. It's out of anywhere I've travelled, if I could go back in a heartbeat, it would be to Jerusalem. And you know, sad to see the situation at the
mm-hmm.
minute, but you can understand why there's so much contention over it. It's just such a surreal, wonderful, wonderful place. So much life. It's like walking into history, but you know, living history
mm.
at the same time. But obviously, you know, people are there making their daily lives.
Must be a strange tension.
It's a very strange tension, and it's somewhere as a Christian that you imagine, you know, as you read through the Bible, you have these pictures in your head of what it's going to be like, and just to see it all come alive around you, it's just amazing.
Yeah, because it's not like if I go to Rome and I go right to the Colosseum and I know
yeah.
that it's gladiators and
yeah.
you know, whatnot. I mean, I'm interested in all that, but it's kind of picture book history. But
yes.
for someone who's a practicing Christian to go to Jerusalem, if they're a poet as well, I can only imagine what kind of effect that has.
Yeah.
I mean, the story of Christ is so poetic in
yeah.
itself already, you know.
Yes.
And
hard to write about because it is. It's, you know, how can you approach it in a way that isn't now been done to death?
or kind of corny, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have to refract it, I suppose. You have to either write about being in Jerusalem
mm-hmm.
or you know, as we've discussed, through your nature kind of poetry.
Yeah. I just, I guess there was so much in Jerusalem that I wanted to kind of get a feel of the place by just recording lots of detail. So I essentially did that. I recorded a lot of detail about, you know, the walls, the ground, what was in the windows, things like that, and just allowed that to take me where it could. But yeah, I would love to go out there. It'd be wonderful.
And so we arrive at the end of another episode of the Scottish Poetry Library's podcast series. Time for a contractually obliged round of thank yous. Many thanks, of course, to Marion McCready for coming in from Crieff to Edinburgh to record that episode with me. And thanks also to Will Campbell, who wrote, performed and produced our theme music. Thanks also to yourself for having listened. Marion's next book, Triptych Number 1, Our Real Red Selves, is out at the end of May, and you can see her perform with her triptych co-pilots, or co-poets rather, J.L. Williams and Harry Giles, on Saturday the 18th of April at 7 p.m. at the Mitchell Library in Glasgow. That's part of the I Write Festival. The Scottish Poetry Library has a show of its own at the I Write Festival, and it takes place the following night, the 19th, at the same venue, the Mitchell Library, and we'll be presenting a show based on our online anthology, Best Scottish Poems 2014. Many of the poets who appear in that anthology will be reading their own work that night and another poem, a Scottish poem, one that inspired them. So there'll be another podcast along in about a fortnight. If you want to keep up with all things SPL-ish in the meantime, you can do so via our Twitter stream, which goes by the name of @ByLeavesWeLive. And we also have a Facebook page, which we update daily. We also have a website, www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org. And we do a fortnightly newsletter, which you can subscribe to very easily. Just go to our homepage. There's a button that says subscribe. Click it. Voila. So we just have time now to say goodbye and to leave you with one last poem by Marion McCreadie.
I'm going to read two sections from a longish poem called Portrait of the Old City, Jerusalem. 2. The church and the soldier frame each other as though asterisms in the old city constellation. A scroll of headscarves, rainbow, a tunnelled wall. One man pointing, the other sitting with a nervous smile. The ceiling speaks Ottoman, the ground Roman red, polished stone, veined with blood memory and footsteps. In the distance, three men run. Freeze-framed, they become uncannily the three on a hill where the penitent one turned to the other in supplication. At the end of the tunnel, light gathers in a bright ball. Candle flowers open up their flames in a row. The men stand out from the walls. A trick of photography has them holding hands, and the Afro trees lean in like women. 7. The men in their black coats gather, their hats ringed planets tilting ahead of them. A walled-up doorway has buried its crimes. The narrow maze of Jerusalem stone hangs on our shoulders. The ridiculous giraffe necks of the palms converse at the city gates. The blue sky dims into mist, and behind the new gate, a straggle of flame clouds lower on the hill. A minaret arm stretches out of the city, a plaza of palms all in a row, the cross-legged olive windswept. Shadows talk in a rooftop garden, the cross wires of the tram line slitting the sky. Two ancient love trees joined at the roots, one leaning east and the other leaning west, red flowers bleeding into white. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you.
Thank you for downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter @ByLeavesWeLive, and find us on Facebook.